I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Coming to a trench near you, Naked Archaeology.
Hello and welcome to Naked Archaeology with me, Diana O'Carroll, and with Duncan Howard Marshall.
Hello.
This month is all about human remains in archaeology. What happened to Bronze Age people who are cremated and buried?
During the beginning of the early Bronze Age, we see the first introduction of cremation as a burial ritual, and this is at first quite sporadic and only occurs occasionally. It then, as the Bronze Age progresses, becomes the most common form of burial, and then eventually, towards the end of the Bronze Age, we find that formal burial rites almost disappear from the landscape.
And Joe Appleby will be taking us through some ancient cremations shortly. Plus, we find out about the DNA legacy left by the earliest settlers in America.
And the point that we're trying to make is, like, there is a lot more diversity in the arrival of Paleo-Indians, in the events that led to the colonization of America's double continent, that the people never had an idea about this before. You know, they thought it was a pretty straightforward, you know, here is a couple of people, a couple of lineages, they arrive. But there is a lot more diversity, a lot more to look into.
And that's Hugo Perego, who's added another 9 lineages to the founding populations of the Americas. Duncan.
Also this month, the repatriation of Noongar leader Yagan's head, the oldest known pet tortoise, and in backyard archaeology, how Tutankhamun was raised from a vat of resin. That's all coming up on Naked Archaeology this month.
Naked Archaeology, exposing the finds.
First up this month, Bronze Age cremations. During the period, which spans roughly from 2000 to 700 BC in the UK, there was a fashion for cremating the dead. And Joe Appleby, a postdoc in the University of Cambridge's archaeology department, has been studying these very early cremation burials, plus some which appear even earlier. And the information that can be drawn from these is quite surprising. Listeners of a sensitive nature are warned that this interview does contain some graphic descriptions of what happens during the cremation process.
I'm looking at the changing nature of burial practices from the mid-3rd millennium BC through to the end of the Bronze Age and trying to figure out the changes in ways that people approached death and burial over that time, in particular looking at the practice of cremation.
And what kind of changes do you see happening?
Well, during the beginning of the early Bronze Age, we see the first introduction of cremation as a burial ritual, and this is at first quite sporadic and only occurs occasionally. It then, as the Bronze Age progresses, becomes the most common form of burial, and then eventually, towards the end of the Bronze Age, we find that formal burial rites almost disappear from the landscape. We find occasional burials, but the majority of the human remains we find are as isolated deposits within settlements. And in fact, we're not very sure what was happening to the majority of dead individuals at all.
And do you have any ideas as to why these changes were occurring?
Well, that's the interesting thing, and what one of the things that my research is aiming to investigate. Because burial is quite a good way at looking into people's minds in the past. Death is a very stressful sort of a time, and therefore, when it comes to funerary behaviour, you don't just do anything. You want to do something that shows your respect for the person that has just died. It has to fit in with your own cultural belief. So obviously, bringing in a dramatic change, like going from burying the body as an inhumation burial to setting fire to it, is something quite dramatic. And in the past, it's often been interpreted as a change of people, a new kind of people coming in. But actually, it's quite difficult to interpret the beginning of cremation straightforwardly in this way because we don't have the evidence that that was occurring. So instead, we see this as a change of belief. And part of what I'm trying to do is to tease out precisely what's actually occurring within the cremation rituals. So not just saying, were they burning the body or were they not burning the body, but looking at what they were doing when they weren't burning the body and what they were actually doing when they were burning the body, and trying to figure out what the similarities and differences were that were occurring.
So you've been working on a Bronze Age site. Can you tell me a bit about that site?
Yes, I've been working on a site from Erith out in the Fens, which was actually excavated by the Cambridge Archaeological Unit. And I've been collaborating with Natasha Dodwell of the Archaeological Unit on this. The site was, it originally consisted of a ring ditch with a central inhumation. This was constructed in the early Bronze Age. And then this later became the focus for a Middle Bronze Age cremation cemetery where over 30 individuals were buried.
And we've got a couple of examples here. So let's look at this big tray. It's full of quite a large collection of small bits of, they look quite burned, bone. What actually do we have here?
Okay, well, we do indeed have a large tray full of quite small burned bits of bone. But what this can do is it can actually tell us a little bit about what was going on. So despite the fact that these bones, to the untrained eye, look as though they could be pretty much anything, they are actually identifiable if you know what you're talking about. So, for example, I can pick out a piece here, which is about 5 centimetres long and quite warped and doesn't look like much of anything. But I can tell you that's probably part of a human tibia. So that's one of the lower leg bones. As well as being able to identify that, I can tell you that the bones in this particular tray are of adult size. So we're dealing with an adult individual. And in fact, this individual has been identified as male. But there are also some infant bones buried in with this individual, I don't think in this particular tray, because the bones are sorted by size and these are much smaller, obviously. So we can determine the age and the sex of individuals and whether we're dealing with one person in a burial or whether we're dealing with more than one person, and that actually occurs relatively frequently. In addition to that, I can tell you something about the temperature at which the bones were burnt. So the majority of the bones in this tray are actually white. And you might think that the skeleton is naturally white, but in fact it's, generally speaking, more of a creamy yellow colour when we excavate human skeletons. And this white colour tells me that the bones have been heated to more than 600 degrees. So that's a high temperature, very efficient cremation practice that we're seeing. In addition, the bones are quite warped and they're quite fractured. And that's to do with the effects that the heat has on the organic component of the bone. So bone is a matrix made out of organic proteins and an inorganic material that gives it a great strength. And obviously when you cremate bone, then you lose the organic component, but you retain the inorganic component. When the organic component is present, the burning up of that causes the bone to warp and change shape. So from the fact that this bone is warped, I can tell that this individual was burnt when the bone was still fresh, as opposed to them having dug up some old bones from somewhere and then set fire to them.
Do you see the same sort of things happening across all the burials?
This kind of practice, I would say, was typical for a burial of this period. In the Middle Bronze Age, cremation was typically quite efficient. It was typically involving individuals soon after death. Generally speaking, it was only one person being burnt at a time. In the earlier period, it was more variable, and in the later period, it was quite weird, and we're not totally sure what was happening.
Okay, we've got another tray here of a collection of, it looks like, 5 bags of all sorts of different bits of bone. So what's going on here? What's different with this one?
Well, these are just some pieces that I picked out to illustrate some of the things that we can see when we look at bone. So here I've got a bag with a piece of tooth in it, and this is, in fact, a human molar. And when we look at it, we can see that we've got some sticky out bits at the bottom, which are actually the roots. And there's not much left of the crown of the tooth. And this is because as the enamel heats up, it actually explodes. So what we tend to find when we find teeth is just the lower proportion. When we do find enamel, it's often because it's unerupted teeth from children, which were still sitting inside the jaw. And so the presence of the bone of the jaw has actually protected the enamel. And so that can be a clue as to the age of the individual that we're dealing with. I also have a bag with a rather large bone in it, which comes from the ankle of the individual. And when we look at this bone, we can see that the coloration on it is quite variable. So it goes from everything to a sort of a dusty brown colour through a bluish grey through to white in certain parts of it. And this is an indication that it's been subjected to varying degrees of heat. So it's not totally burnt out. There was still organic material remaining in this bone at the end of the cremation process.
Do you find that that happens a lot to extremities like feet?
Well, it's quite interesting because it happens according to the amount of tissue that is protecting the bone. And obviously, right within the ankle joint, which is where this bone has come from, then there's quite a lot surrounding it of quite dense material that's preventing it. But actually, we find that some parts of the body, which we wouldn't expect to survive in that fashion, do quite well. And that's because of the way that the body reacts to extreme heat. So when you cremate a body, the heat actually causes certain muscle groups to contract, and that puts the body into a position that is known as the pugilistic posture, where the arms are drawn up, the hands contract into fists, the legs go into what looks almost like a frog-like sort of a posture. And this means, for example, that the very ends of your finger bones, which you might expect to be burnt very early in the process because there's not much flesh around them, actually when they're drawn into the fist, then they're very much protected. And so they're one of the last bones that burns. So here I've actually got the very end finger bone from somebody's hand that survived the burning process quite well.
Oh, it's absolutely tiny. It is incredible that something so small has survived.
Yes. And of course, sometimes what happens is that these smaller bones actually fall through the pyre, and that can be another reason why they get protected and don't get burnt up so much.
And these bones are all several thousand years old. So how is it that they can survive even though they've been burned quite heavily and then presumably interred in the earth?
Well, we have a slightly strange idea about what cremated bone ought to look like, because when our beloved relatives sadly die and we take them down to the local crematorium, what we get back is an urn full of tiny, unrecognisable ashes. That's not actually what you get at the end of the cremation process. What you get at the end of the cremation process is essentially a skeleton where some of the bones are a bit fragmented, but they come in very large pieces. And because they've been burnt, they're brittle, but they're still very recognisable. And in modern crematoria, they actually have a special machine that breaks up the bones into a powder so that you cannot recognise any specific part of your relative if you decide to scatter the ashes, because that would obviously be upsetting for you. So these individuals in prehistory would have gone into the ground in really very large pieces. And whilst they don't survive complete, they survive reasonably well. And in fact, cremated bone actually, in many conditions, survives better than uncremated bone.
So if you want someone to find you in a few thousand years and you're currently in a temperate climate, perhaps the best option is to get cremated the Bronze Age way. That was Joe Appleby from the Department of Archaeology at the University of Cambridge. But it's now time for some news. So, Duncan, what have you got for us?
Well, the first news item this month is the repatriation and recent reburial of the head of an Australian Aboriginal warrior who was killed and beheaded by colonial settlers in 1833. Now, in line with common practice at the time, his head was transported to England, where it was put on display in a museum as an anthropological curiosity, and eventually buried in an unmarked plot in a cemetery in Liverpool. His head has now been finally laid to rest in a traditional ceremony in a memorial park near the site where it is believed the warrior was killed 177 years ago in Western Australia.
So, who was he?
We know bits and pieces from the Noongar of Western Australia. There are accounts from white settlers at the time. His name was Yagan, and he was a leader of the Noongar tribe at the time when British settlers were first moving into the area around modern-day Perth. Relations between the Noongar and the newly arrived British were initially very good, but sadly this harmony didn't last, and there were misunderstandings regarding land management practices, where white settlers were essentially fencing off land for farming. Now, Yagan and the Noongar led something of an uprising against this, and as a result were implicated in the killing of several settlers. Now, they were declared outlaws, and a reward was offered for their capture.
But what happened next?
Well, Yagan wasn't without sympathy from members of the settler community, but even so, on the 11th of July 1833, Yagan was killed by two teenage brothers and his head was cut off to claim the reward. Now, the head was transported to England and eventually put on display in Liverpool Museum.
Okay, that sounds more medieval than 19th century, but what's happened since then?
Well, the Noongar people have been campaigning for the return of Yagan's head since the early 1980s, entrusting tribal elder Ken Golbung with the task of locating the head in England. Now, he used the help of University of London archaeologists Peter Ucko and Cressida Ford, and successfully located the head in 1993. but it took nearly 6 years for it to be repatriated to Western Australia due to political wrangling and reported divisions within the Noongar community itself. Now, it's taken another 12 years for his remains to be reburied. Now, the delayed reburial of the head, which took place on the 10th of July, the last full day Yagan was alive 177 years ago, was due to disputes over the actual location of the site where he was killed. Now, the site is now the Yagan Memorial Park, and the traditional ceremony was attended by around 300 people, including Noongars and state representatives.
That's quite a turnout. But do you think that this will prompt the repatriation and reburial of other remains of Aboriginal people which are in museum collections all over the world?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This certainly isn't a new phenomenon. In fact, the repatriation of Aboriginal remains has been going on for quite some time now. I was attending the World Archaeological Congress in Dublin in 2008, where the issue of repatriation of human remains was very much on the agenda. And the overwhelming feeling among the archaeological community is to work side by side with the descendant communities to bring the remains of their ancestors back and rebury them according to their traditional beliefs. I think we'll see much more of this in the future.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true, but I'd be surprised if the process became any easier. But on a lighter note, this next archaeological discovery at Stafford Castle can tell us something of the early relationship we had with domestic pets in the 19th century.
So what have they found at Stafford Castle, Dinah?
Well, archaeologist Dr. Richard Thomas from the University of Leicester discovered a rather unusual leg bone amongst the skeletal remains of cats and dogs in the castle grounds dating to the late 19th century. And the leg bone was identified as belonging to a tortoise, perhaps the earliest evidence of such an animal being kept as a family pet in Britain. And these finds have been reported in the journal Post-Medieval Archaeology.
But how do we know the tortoise was being kept as a family pet?
Well, that's a good question. The fact that it was discovered alongside the remains of cats and dogs is a good indicator that this tortoise was being kept as a pet by the caretaker family, and they were living at the castle at the time. So Dr. Thomas stated that whilst there is archaeological evidence in Britain for turtles and terrapins from the 17th century onwards, these were largely kept for food, and the discovery at Stafford Castle is the first evidence we have for a land tortoise. Now, the 19th century was also a turning point in the general attitude society had towards animals as domestic pets.
What do you mean?
Well, in medieval and early modern Britain, society was deeply religious, and the morality of keeping animals as pets was highly suspect. So exotic creatures, particularly those from outside Europe, generated a great deal of curiosity and fascination, but to keep them as companions was socially unacceptable. So domesticated animals were kept for food, milk, cheese, butter, meat, wool, leather, and so on and so on. In the case of dogs, many were kept, obviously, for hunting and herding. However, things began to change in the 17th century with the dog-loving Stuart kings.
Oh yes, I love those 17th century portraits of members of the House of Stuart sitting alongside their fluffy-eared King Charles Cavalier Spaniels.
Exactly right, and dogs especially were seen as wonderful companions to have around the house, or in their case, the palace. And so certain animals were now seen in a different light. And the famous 19th century sculptor Joseph Gott created a number of very sentimental sculptures of animals. And in 1822, the British government passed the Richard Martins Act, which prevented cruelty to farm animals. And this paved the way for the foundation of the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in 1824, which was the first animal welfare charity to be established anywhere in the world. And it was granted its royal status in 1840 by Queen Victoria.
What an incredible achievement, and something that I think we should all be very, very proud of. I guess the founding of the RSPCA set into motion all kinds of wonderful movements around the world dedicated to animal welfare issues that continue on to this day. But what of our tortoise bone at Stafford Castle?
Well, tortoises were unusual, but it was this age-old fascination with the exotic that made them desirable as pets around this time. But sadly, their popularity in the 20th century meant that thousands of wild tortoises were transported from the Mediterranean and North Africa to the UK, but they suffered terrible conditions, only to end up as pets in households which couldn't look after them properly. It was only with European legislation in 1988 that made the trade in wild tortoises illegal.
So there is a happy ending. This is Naked Archaeology with the Naked Scientists. If you'd like to get in touch, then email us with the address archaeology@thenakedscientists.com. You can also find more episodes like this at thenakedscientists.com/archaeology or on iTunes. But let's move from old endings to early beginnings now, and the founding populations of the Americas. Up till now, only 6 founding female lineages of Native American peoples had been identified, which indicated a very simplistic and small-scale migration into the continent sometime around 15 to 18,000 years before present. Now, Hugo Perego and colleagues have looked at the whole mitochondrial sequence. That's the genetic information passed down the female line, and identified another 9 founding mothers.
One of the things we realized in 2008 was that almost every single Native American mitochondrial DNA lineage could be traced to one of 6 founders. And so we did 2 things. One was looking at this particular lineage, which was one of the 6. And as we did complete sequences on it, we realized that this particular lineage was actually split in 2 branches, which was not known before. So now, from the 6 original, we discovered that we have 7, because one is split in 2. In the meantime, we also added some of the lineages that we personally discovered in the last couple of years, and we realized, like, wait a second, you know, not only we were able to better define the one lineage that was one of the main founding lineages, but now we realize there are 15 founding lineages between the study of the lineage we're doing, which is called C1D, and then we realize the other lineages have also some split that can be tied back to the 15,000, 18,000 years ago estimated arrival of Paleo-Indians to the Americas. And the point we're trying to make is, like, there is a lot more diversity in the arrival of Paleo-Indians, in the events that led to the colonization of America's double continent, that the people never had an idea about this before. You know, they thought it was a pretty straightforward, you know, here is a couple of people, a couple of lineages, they arrive. But there is a lot more diversity, a lot more to look into.
How did you go about collecting the data for this? You mentioned that you looked at a few other papers that other people had published as well, but what other resources did you use to get this information?
Yes, I am a research scientist for a non-profit organization in Utah called the Sorenson Molecular Genealogy Foundation. Since 1999, we've been building one of the largest databases of correlated genealogical and genetic data. So we've been traveling the world, literally, and we have worked with many organizations and collected over 110,000 DNA samples together with ethnical, linguistic, and genealogical data associated to it. So we run a small section of DNA. You know, we sequence just a small component, but in that component there is enough variety that we can pick up samples from this large database that look particularly interesting. And so since we have a clue of what to look for the underrepresented lineages, what we do a careful screening of all this data, and we handpick each one of them that has some of the characteristics we're looking for that we assume would fit into some of those lineages that we are looking for. And then I took these DNA samples to the University of Pavia under the direction of Professor Antonio Torroni and Alessandro Achilli. And we can confirm, once you have the complete sequence, because a complete sequence does not hide anything. Your show is The Naked Scientist. You know, we have a naked mitochondrial DNA, and there is nothing to hide. You know, you see it all. And so based on now the complete sequences, we are able to ascertain and confirm that the DNA belong to the lineages we are looking for and exclude others that we thought they were, but they're not. And so we're able to build these trees that are very comprehensive and allow for better dating and distribution and so on. We also use some collaborators in Austria, Argentina, and Spain that help us with some additional DNA samples.
Okay. And you mentioned that there are these 15 lineages now that we can identify, but not all lineages manage to survive in current modern-day populations. Is there any way that we can even estimate how many lineages have become extinct?
That's a very good question, and one that we are continually working on. What one thing that we're doing is that we acknowledge that it will be impossible probably to have an exact idea of every single lineage that came here and contributed to the original population. And as you know, the history of the Americas has been quietly changed through the years because of colonization by the European and disease and warfare. So, you know, many, many people, many tribal groups have been completely wiped out. So I have a feeling that due to genetic randomness, which, you know, genetic drift, and some of the events that characterize the history of the Americas, some of these lineages are lost forever. You'll never be able to know them. But one thing we can do, if we can continue provide complete sequences of whatever Native American lineage we are finding, that we will be able to at least approach the number of original founders and get closer to it more than ever before. The example comes from the lineage that we analyzed in this paper, where they thought there was one founding lineage, and then when we did complete sequences of 63 additional lineages, we found that there were two founding lineages and not one. That could have happened only with the complete sequences. So now we want to go back and do more complete sequences of some of the branches that we already have on the tree, plus others, and continue to add to the picture, the overall understanding of how many founding events characterize the colonization and expansion of Paleo-Indians.
You mentioned one of these lineages you were able to date to 15 to 18,000 years ago, but what about the 5,000-year-old piece of hair from Greenland?
That's a very good question. So our 15 to 18,000 age estimates is based on mitochondrial DNA sequences for the major haplogroups that contributed to all the Native Americans for North, Central, and South America. But what we are not saying that that was the only pre-Columbian event that contributed to the peopling of this continent. What we are saying is that that was that mark, the first arrival. In fact, that coincides with the end of the last glacial maximum. And so as the ice sheet melted away and climate condition improved 15 to 18,000 years ago at the end of the last glacial maximum, then the people that were trapped in Beringia, the Paleo-Indians that were trapped in Beringia, were able to make their move into the Americas. That does not exclude that other groups were also arriving either at the same time or more recently, but always before the Europeans, so, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 years ago, which include these people that have been recently analyzed, which contributed to the peopling of Greenland, and they most likely came from Asia around the North Pole, probably still traveling on ice sheet into North America. However, the DNA lineage of the one individual from Greenland is very rare and has not been found in Central or South America, showing that after the initial arrival, something happened that did not allow the group to expand any further than where they arrived. So they arrived there, they lived there for a while, and then something happened that they became extinct as a people and the genetic lineages, and they have not been part of contributing to the Pan-American Native Americans, which is one of the lineages that we study, the C1D I was telling you about, that's found in North, Central, and South America, and that's why it's considered a founding lineage.
So the more recent migration into Greenland doesn't count as a founding lineage, but it does help to demonstrate that the peopling of the Americas was probably far more complex than we currently realize. That was Hugo Perego from the Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation.
Thanks, Duncan. It's now time for Backyard Archaeology, and this time we're going to New York's backyard, or at least Times Square, where a rather beautiful recreation of King Tutankhamun's mummy is on display. But how are these replicas put together? Gary Staub.
Well, I've been lucky in that I've worked in museums all of my life, and when a scientist wants to bring an artifact out for the public to touch or restore a skull to its flesh appearance, that's when I get called in. So I look at bones and I look at artifacts and try and produce those in the most lifelike and realistic way as possible. So my job is to work with science and bring that to art and kind of make it very acceptable for the general public.
And what about King Tutankhamun? I understand that you've been working on a project very closely with the researchers on that.
Yes, we were approached by National Geographic Society to produce a replica of the mummy of King Tut. And the beauty of that was, one, it involved the trip to the Valley of the Kings to actually go measure and photograph the mummy itself, which was very exciting. But also, it involved a very neat bit of technology where we, since the mummy has been scanned, there's a lot of research and data, obviously, that's been generated about that find over decades and decades of of work, we were able to take the CT scans and then rapid prototype from that information an actual three-dimensional model to work from.
So can you go into a little bit more detail about the process? So you applied these CT scans, and then what happens then once you've, presumably you build up a digital sort of profile of what it's going to look like?
Sure. It's a very neat process, and there's only one machine in the world that's able to do it at the scale that we did it with Tutankhamun, and it's in Belgium. And the company, Materialize, took this data, this 3D data, and they fire a laser into a big vat of photoreactive resin, and it catalyzes, it hardens that resin in tiny increments, in tenths of millimeter increments, and it builds it up slowly and slowly over time until you get that. So it takes just about 6 days to build up a full skeleton, or in this case, the mummy. And Tutankhamun's mummy does not have a lot of soft tissue associated with it, so it's very close to the skeletal form. And so the trick of it was trying to pick from the CT scans actual soft tissues, because in a normal person, when you're looking at those CT scans, you're able to very easily delineate what is soft tissue and what is bone. But when you get to mummify a person who's gone through all of these different processes in order to preserve the flesh, that flesh gets very dense and shrunken. And so it becomes quite a delicate process to pick out the flesh from the bone densities in the scans. And so the people at Materialize were fantastic in doing all that work.
What happens when you have the carved out mummy? Do you essentially color it in?
Right. So my job is to take this thing, and when the resin hardens after the laser hits it, they lift it out of this vat. So it's this mummy rising out of this big vat of resin, and it's clear like glass. So it's very difficult to actually read the surface of it. So my job is to take that bit, and which looks just like cast glass, perfectly clear and beautiful, and then make it look like desiccated flesh. So that's the fun part of it, and that's where the art comes in, and that's where the observation is so very important. So having firsthand observation experience with your subject is so very critical in the process. So I took notes, color references, all of the things that would be important in trying to reproduce it. So things you have to think about are, there's skin pore detail on the mummy. There's areas where the fabric have been and wrapping have been embedded into the flesh and left its impression. So once the texture is done, of course, we have to go back and match all of those colors to try and make sure all of that is done as spot on as possible. So all of those things are things that we try and reproduce as accurately as possible.
And what next? Who gets to see this and who gets to use this?
Right, so it's for an exhibition that's currently running at the Discovery Times Square exhibition space in New York City. And it's going to be on display until January of this year.
What do you think is going to happen next in this field? It sounds like a really exciting bit of museum displays. So do you think there's going to be any new fantastic technological developments that could really enhance visitors' experiences when they go around a museum?
It's a great and exciting time. It's a little bit scary for a person who has made their living creating sculptures by hand and doing restorations by hand, because there's all of this digital 3D printing going on. But I still think there's always going to be room for the artists in creating sculptures for museums, because the printing is very detailed, but it's still not quite there as far as surface and color goes. So there's still, at least for a while, room for folks like myself doing this work, and of course working clay to do facial restorations. But yes, it is. It's a very exciting time, and so I just wait to see what the new, in 5 years, what will be the new methods for reproducing fossils, reproducing artifacts, all sorts of things that, we couldn't do or that are too fragile to reproduce. Just now we can just scan a lot of those things and do 3D prints of them. So it's very valuable for archiving bones and artifacts, and also for reproducing them in a way that's non-invasive.
That was Gary Starb from Starb Studios, and you can see a video of this amazing process on YouTube. Just search for The Making of the Replica King Tut. The real thing, well, the replica, that is on display at the Discovery Times Square Exposition. That's it for Naked Archaeology this month, but a reminder for our survey. It's coming up to 10 years of the Naked Scientists, and we're running a survey to find out how you think we could improve our shows and discover exactly who is listening to us. As an added incentive, we're also offering Amazon vouchers worth £10 to 10 lucky respondents who answer by the 10th of the 10th, 2010. You can find the survey at thenakedscientists.com/survey. But if you'd like to get in touch, then you can still email us with the address archaeology@thenakedscientists.com, and you can also find more episodes like this at thenakedscientists.com/archaeology or on iTunes.
Laying the artifacts bare. Naked Archaeology.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.